many doctorates would have been awarded up, let's say, to the time of the Second World War? Your first one was in 37?
Yes. I'll look that up and put some information on that. We did have, as I said before, very large classes in our evening students right after the World War due to the GI Bill of Rights. I remember one of the years we gave some 12 doctorates from chemical engineering, as well as 25 or more masters, which has never, of course, been equaled since. The tendency of graduate education has changed quite considerably. In those days, our population of graduate students was almost entirely part-time. However, with the disappearance from the New York area of the executive, engineering, and scientific offices and laboratories of the chemical, engineering, and petroleum companies, we do not have nearly as large a population of part-time students. And so nowadays, full-time students expect and receive various aids, tuitions, or fellowships for conducting their research work.
When the Second World War broke out, what impact did that have on your department?
Well, not so much. We were very cramped for space, and we also then took in a large number, and I can't tell you the numbers, of officers, junior officers for the Army. Wait a minute, these were, I guess, mainly enlisted men and some officers, that was it. We had the nuisance, as everybody does that works with any branch of the government, of having to go along with governmental regulations and red tape. Somebody had told the Department of Defense, or the Army, as it was then called, that college education should be on a four-semester basis rather than on a two-semester basis. And that meant that within the ordinary two-semester time, what is usually done is put three semesters. So we had to be teaching the same courses to our civilian students on our regular basis of two semesters, and to the Army the same courses, the same professors, different students, different clothing, of course, on a three-semester basis, which was somewhat of a nuisance. Also, one of those years, and I don't remember whether it was 1943, probably, we had three commencements. Due to the mix-up of these classes, we had to have a commencement at one time, or maybe it was two times for the Army and one time for our civilian students. But I think that was the only year in the history of Polytechnic we ever had a three commencement, because the normal practice has been that if a student finishes, we'll say any time after a commencement, if he may finish his thesis at the end of the summer, he still doesn't get his degree until the following June. But here, on account of the Army and the fact these boys were going off to the war directly from here, many of them into combat duty, I suppose, we had to give them their degree when they finished at these odd times of the year.
Had you expanded your faculty any? You said you had a lot of adjunct people, but
we were fortunate to get top-notch people. Sometimes they had been our own people who had then shown extraordinary ability. One, for example, was Donald Q. Kern, who was working for his doctorate and then received it, did his work in the laboratories of Foster Wheeler over in Carteret, New Jersey, on heat transfer. He, exceptionally able, took thermodynamics also from the mechanical engineering department, where thermodynamics is often taught mainly as a course in steam engines, and he, however, was so much more concerned with the fundamental aspects of thermodynamics, and he asked so many questions that the head of the department who taught the course and who had written the textbook on this mechanical engineering thermodynamics told me never to send another chemical engineer of my graduate courses to him to allow him to take his thermodynamic courses because he was too much of a nuisance. Meanwhile, partly while he was still here, he was also an adjunct professor, and he wrote the book, the classic book, which is still, I think, in print and still referred to constantly in heat transfer. Certainly the most important single book on heat transfer that has ever been written, published by McGraw-Hill.
Were there any other
faculty? I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, you wonder if you had expanded. There were only a few of you in 35, by the time
we had other, we had other top-notch people also. One other one I remember was Carl Gamer, who had received the prize for the best thesis in his undergraduate work. He was of the class of 34 and had gone on then afterward, worked in industry, got his master's and most of his doctorate work finished. While he was working for the Lummis Company, of which he ultimately became vice president. But in this 1934 bachelor's thesis, I said to him about Christmas time of his senior year, "Carl, where have you been, and why aren't you working on your thesis, and where are you?" "Oh," he said, "Doc, I've got it all done." And I said, "Well, I know you haven't been doing it here. You told me you were working at home." "Oh, yes, I set up a laboratory in my basement, and I've got it all done, and I'll show you." Well, of course, he didn't have it all done, but by the time he did finish it then, he had by far the best thesis and won what we call the Raymond Prize for the best undergraduate thesis of that particular year. It was a thesis on the production of oxalic acid, OXALIC, from sawdust, and he'd done beautiful work in making it, but then particularly in the analysis of the products which were made. He, as I say, then after the war became one of our adjunct professors in petroleum refining and petroleum equipment design, because of his meanwhile he had been working with the Lummis Company in their building of plants and other petroleum equipment and petrochemical equipment throughout the world, for one of which jobs in building, in designing a refinery in Finland, he received the highest order of the Finnish government for the increase in the ability of Finland to manufacture its own petroleum products. But that, and these men, these two or three that I mentioned, were only part of the, only a few of the outstanding young men that I was able to recruit for teaching specialized graduate courses. And that without expanding our normal faculty, and as I might add, at a considerable saving in cash amounts, because these men were paid on an a la carte basis for each lecture they gave, which was very substantially less than if they had been on the full-time faculty, carrying, say, a dozen or so hours a week of classwork.
How many full-time faculty did you have around the time of the war started?
Not so many. I'd have to look. Five or six was all. As a matter of fact, there was some criticism as to how, and at a later time, we did adjust and have more full-time people and less of this part-time. But it was the only way that would have been economic to handle the load after the war years. And we then lost these people by attrition as they got more responsibility. They were almost always relatively young men, but as they got more responsibilities in their full-time jobs, we would lose them, and instead of recruiting them, I put on more full-time people, a lesser number.
At the time you had five or six full-time faculty, how many adjunct faculty would you have had?
Oh, at that time we would have had maybe eight or nine.
Okay.
Each one, of course, teaching only one particular graduate course. We did have, I'm not sure whether we had any adjunct faculty teaching undergraduate courses. At the moment, I can't think of any. We did develop courses in biochemical engineering at that time, and in chemical engineering economics on both the graduate and undergraduate levels, and some other rather specialized courses. After the war, we also developed both a graduate and undergraduate course in nuclear engineering, which was very popular for a while, but then gradually fell off. And at that time, I had the opportunity of buying or obtaining practically without cost a rather very small nuclear reactor, but we never could find the place in our crowded confines of central Brooklyn to do anything about installation of it. And probably just as well, because it might have been troublesome.
During the war, your processes were used in making RDX, cyclamite.
Oh, yes.
Were you personally involved with that?
Only at the only at the start. I was invited to Canada to discuss to give a series of lectures by the Canadian Chemical Society. The invitation came in a rather odd way, and I was a little surprised, but I accepted it, and it did give the lectures. But during the time I was in Toronto, I was invited to discuss some matters and got into the chemistry of making RDX with some people whose entire background I didn't know, although they were supposed to be with, or they were with a chemical company. At a later time, a few months later, I ran into these same people in Kingsport, Tennessee, at the Tennessee Eastman Company. Why they were there, I was, at this time, I had licensed another process or a modification of the process of concentrating acetic acid to Eastman Kodak, which and then had become a consultant to them. I think earlier in this discussion I mentioned difficulties of working with them because of their secrecy, but in this case we discussed ordinary problems that were concerned with the expansion of Tennessee Eastman's acetic acid recovery, and then that was it. Had my very minor consulting work to do for them, one involving some laboratory work that one of my students did, and gradually this contact with Kodak went down, although and Kodak had the right to, that is Tennessee Eastman had the right to cancel this consulting arrangement. Suddenly they did this during the war. I thought nothing of it, except that, well, I had built their plant, they'd paid me a good fee for the patent rights, and after all, consulting work with Tennessee Eastman was difficult because they didn't want to let not the left hand know what the right hand was doing, but didn't even want to know the right hand to know the shape of the fingernails he was supposed to file on the left hand. So it was rather difficult, and I thought nothing particularly above it. Well, I was sorry to lose the fee. Many years later, I found that this process, my process, which Tennessee Eastman had the right to use for their cellulose acetate manufacture, was the basis of the production or the recovery of all of the acetic acid used in the making of RDX by a separate corporation which Tennessee Eastman had set up called the Holston, H-O-L-S-T-O-N, Ordnance Company, and had built the plant a few miles or less from the main plant of Tennessee Eastman. Oddly enough, several years ago, which was of course many years after the war, the Department of the Army indirectly got in touch with me to review the plans of the Holston Ordnance Works using my process because they wanted to have a backup in case it ever became necessary to use it again. Well, that of course is that sort of thing is corporate policy, and during the war it was necessary to keep a minimum of people to know a minimum of things, and since by this time Tennessee Eastman knew well enough how to build acetic acid recovery processes after the Othmer patents, why there was no reason why I should be continue to be involved, and I wasn't. I'm not saying that they did not have the right to, but and I'm not saying that it was anything unethical. But it was surprising to find this out indirectly several years later, or 10 years later, and then to actually have to review the plans 40 years later.
You weren't aware of the RDX aspect until after the war?
No. No, I had run into it first in Canada, where I was invited, and I think the main reason was to ask to pump me to get my ideas and guesses as to costs of recovery and so on. And this was at a very formative period in the question of making RDX. The inventor, or at least he then, many years later, described this in a journal article in the American Chemical Society, which I never ever saw even, because it was about something, the titles were not relating to acetic acid, because acetic acid was only the main media of the reaction, the same as in making cellulose acetate. And then, of course, it wasn't till long later that. But most of the RDX made during the war, I have been told, or had from various sources, was made by the Holston Ordnance Company.
You said that Canadian invitation came in an odd way. What?
I don't remember. I don't remember why they should have been asking me, and I was, I guess, a little surprised. But I went.
Do you remember the name of the RDX inventor?
No, I could look it up.
Okay, well, we can
check that. I don't remember.
Okay. I also have a note here that says that you were trained by the government to be an evaluator for the liberated German chemical industry.
This was an odd thing during the war, and it may have been, let me see, 45, 44, sometime in 43, early 43, and a gentleman whose name even I forget now, called from Washington, invited, would I have lunch with him over at the Pennsylvania Station, the restaurant that was a good restaurant there then, and I did. And he was sounding me out as to my availability and other aspects of my background and familiarity with the chemical industry. And so on, and he was of the military intelligence, and there was one or two other meetings. Don't remember as he ever called on me at my office, but finally, and I had agreed my that I was available, having no family responsibilities and obviously available from the school for anything that would be worthwhile in the war effort. I got a telegram then one day, as I remember, in early June, which said, please, or no, I don't think they used the word please, enter the northwest entrance of such and such, and I forget the name of the school building, or the location in the outskirts of Washington, at 8 minutes after four on such and such a day, and I forget the date, it was early June, maybe about the sixth or thereabouts. And I read it, and was signed by whomever had been my intermediate. So I did show up at 8 minutes after four on this afternoon at the northwest corner, thinking, well, this is all very Boy Scoutish, and so on. And immediately on entering, I was passed to one room, asked to strip completely, and was given a GI issue of clothes, except for my shoes and socks, as I remember, and told, oh, I knew ahead of time, or the telegram had told me, or I'd understood ahead of time anyway, that I would be incommunicado for something like 8 or 10 days. And I must have known this ahead of time before getting this telegram. Anyway, I was then given this very baggy GI issue of fatigues, told not to take anything with me that had in any way my initials. I couldn't take my billfold, no money, and anything that would have my monogram on, I was told had to be released. I, of course, was given a receipt for my clothes, and turned out in this fatigues, except for my shoes and socks. I must have been advised ahead of time to bring some extra socks, but I know I never had another pair of shoes, because I wore these same shoes all the time. We were then loaded, there was a total of 17 men in this group, and I saw then the reason for the 8 minutes. We were given a 3-minute headway in entrance so that we would not see each other in our normal clothes. I immediately recognized, and after just robing and checking our clothes, I immediately recognized another chemical engineer. We, in the lot, who was a professor at Yale, Harding Bliss, B-L-I-S-S. They gave me and gave everybody a pseudonym with the instructions that we were not to divulge anything about ourselves to anybody. And each of us, however, was supposed to find out by hook or crook anything we could find out about any of our colleagues in this. We then went through what somebody has written a book about. We were the 58th group. The 58th group. I forget now how I knew that identified, that had been on this same spy school mission. They were not necessarily all in the same place, but our group then was loaded onto a truck, an army truck, Some of us sat on the back with our legs hanging down. Others were seated in the thing. We went through the streets of Washington, crossed the bridge, and down into Fairfax County, Virginia.